external derivatives and the co-derivative, and use them to define the D'Alembert operator. I will still remind the manifold is the D'Alembert operator, and I will remind the manifold when the metric is quite definite. It will be called a Laplace operator. In the mathematics literature, it may be called a Laplace operator in every circumstance. So we study the Laplace operator made out of the co-derivative and the external derivative. We discussed where it arises. Namely, it arises in the definition of the Bernoulli equation. Can you please close the door? Thanks a lot. Now,
did we have to go through all this trouble of defining the exterior derivative and the co-derivative only to produce the D'Alembert operator for the Klein-Gödel equation? Or do the co-derivative and exterior derivative also have a role to play in other equations of motion directly? And the answer is yes, in particular in electrodynamics. A quick review of the Maxwell equations in this new language is this. Let us collect the electric field strength and the magnetic field strength in this anti-symmetric matrix here, the 4x4 matrix. It is anti-symmetric, and we can use it, this matrix that we will call F mu nu, to define a two form. After all, this is anti-symmetric, and the only thing that is needed to define a form is that you have anti-symmetric coefficients. So this is the field strength two form of electromagnetism. In electromagnetism, also the current and the charges are very important, the charge densities and the current densities. There are two ways of describing them. You could either describe them in terms of a current four vector, or more precisely, a current four vector field, where the zero component is the charge density as a function of space and time, and the three space components are the current density as a function of space and time. But you can also apply to this, you can view this as a contravariant vector, but you can also pull down the index and view it as a covariant vector, in which case it is a one form, the current one form. And then you can apply to the current one form the Hodge star operation, which turns it into a three form. Remember that an R form is mapped into an N minus R form by the Hodge star operation. So in addition to the current one form, you also have a current three form. And depending on the circumstances, you may want to work with the one or the other. This is the way it looks like when you have a three form. Here, I did not allow for a non-trivial metric. This is just the Maxwell equations on flat space. But it's not hard to generalize that to curved space. Simply have to put a square root of g in there from the application of the Hodge star operation. Remember that the Hodge star operation involved the volume form, which had a square root of g. Sorry, I forgot it. You should put a square root of g in there to have it fully general. And then it turns out that the Maxwell equations take this very simple form. Namely, the exterior derivative of the field strength two form is vanishing, and the co-derivative of the field strength two form is the current one form. See, if J is the current three form, then the star of it is the current one form. Remember that F is a two form, exterior derivative of it is a three form, which here it is claimed is vanishing. F is a two form, the co-derivative of it is a one form, and it is the star of this three form, the one form. It turns out that these, the so-called inhomogeneous Maxwell equations, which have currents and charges on the right-hand side, a non-trivial dynamic equation, where these are really of a different kind. They are of a different kind because they are guaranteed by the mathematical setup. You don't have to do experiments to verify whether that's right. As soon as it subscribes to the mathematical language, this is automatic already. This is what is called a structural equation, or a Bianchi identity, or Bianchi identity. And the way to see this is as follows. In electrodynamics, the field strength 2 tensor is assumed to be an exact 2 form, which is to say that it is the exterior derivative of a 1 form. And this 1 form is called the 4 potential that you may have seen, where the 0 component would be an electric potential, and then you have the vector potential in the spatial components for the magnetic field. Now, under this assumption that F is an exact 2 form, meaning that F is the exterior derivative of a 1 form, this first set of Maxwell equations, the homogeneous ones, really follows trivially. It's simply saying that dF is the second exterior derivative of A, which is, of course, 0, because it's the boundary of a boundary, once we use Stokes' theorem. As I said, this is a structural equation. Not always true that F is an exact 2 form. You could have, theoretically, magnetic monopoles. You could have holes in the manifold, and where the monopole sits, and you could have that this is not quite the case. But generally, this is a good assumption. You can also look at the gauge principle from this mathematical perspective. If you remember from electrodynamics, the gauge principle means that the assumption that F is the exterior derivative of A does not fix what A is. A is not unique. You can have the same F and different A. Different A's can have the same exterior derivative. And your choice of A for given F is the choice of gauge. Concretely, you can have that the same field strength 2 form is the exterior derivative of a 1 form A, and also the exterior derivative of a 1 form A tilde, as long as, and so I'm saying that this happens whenever the difference between this 1 form and that 1 form, which we may call a 1 form beta, is itself exact. See, this is because if the difference between A and A tilde is an exact form, then the D of that difference is 0. And therefore, we have that F is unchanged by adding. Right? I mean, if you add to A the D of something, then it doesn't show in F because you would have DD of it. Now, what is the significance of the D'Alembert operator on P form? So far, we only looked at the significance of the D'Alembert operator on zero form, on function. That was the Klein-Gordon equation. But the D'Alembert operator acts on all forms. Because, if you remember, the D'Alembert operator is simply d del plus del d. And those operators act on all differential forms. Now, it turns out that there is a big Hilbert space in this game, and the D'Alembert operator is a self-adjoint operator on that Hilbert space. Let's start with zero form. The hot star operator provides us with a scalar product, or an inner product, for the set of zero forms. Namely, if alpha and beta are zero forms, we can define their inner product, their Hilbert space inner product, to be the integral over A veg hot star beta. Alpha is a zero form. Beta is a zero form. So their wedge product would be their product, which would still be a zero form. We can't integrate zero form. But the star of beta, if beta is a zero form, is a four form. Or generally an n form. And therefore we have a zero form, wedge, an n form. That in total gives us an n form, which we can integrate over the entire manifold. Concretely, what does the star do? Well, in effect, it gives us the square root of g. And because we take the zero, we take a zero form and make it into a four form, and that simply means that we get the volume form involved in a trivial way. So that the inner product between two scalar functions on the manifold is given in this way. You may have seen that before with the square root of g. Turns out that this combination works for arbitrary forms, not just for zero form. We can define the inner product between an R form and another R form to be the integral over the first R form, alpha, veg, star of beta. See, if this is an R form, this is an N minus R form. Therefore, the veg product is an N form, and that we can integrate over the entire manifold. And this definition can then be extended linearly to forms that are linear combinations, even of forms of arbitrary degree. Oh, we lost somebody and get them back. So what we have is that the set of all differential forms on the manifold becomes a Hilbert space by completion. Remember what that means analytically speaking. I mean, analysis is not really our topic in this course, but it means that all Cauchy sequences are converged, so you have to complete the space.
Transformation. I never understood it very well. Like, does it tell us something fundamental about physics? Is it just a mathematical freedom
So far, it is not known what the origin is of the gauge principle. Roughly speaking, what it is that we say the mathematics offers more ways of describing something than is physically distinguishable. Roughly, that is what is behind the gauge principle. But what the ultimate physical intuition for that is not obvious. I made a proposal myself, but this is in a paper some years ago, and my conjecture would be that the gauge principle is expressing that there are degrees of freedom beyond a certain cutoff length, degrees of freedom that are smaller than the Planck length, for example. Ordinarily, they would be external degrees of freedom, just the usual kind of degree of freedom. But because they are beyond what can be observed, what can be resolved, you have to express that they can't be resolved. And my conjecture would be that internal degrees of freedom are really just external degrees of freedom beyond that cutoff. But there are other ideas as well, and I don't think this is close to being accepted at all.
But the mathematical description that we started here carries very far. This works also for non-abelian gauge theory, which is to say that it applies not only to electromagnetism, but also to the strong and the weak form. Now, in this Hilbert space that we just defined, the Hilbert space of differential forms equipped with this inner product, what role does this co-derivative play? It turns out that it is completely determined by the exterior derivative. remember that the co-derivative was defined as a derivation on the space of differential form, on the Grassmann algebra of differential form. It was reducing the degree of a differential form, namely by acting in this way. The co-derivative takes an R-form and maps it into what you obtain when you apply the Hodge star on the R-form, which makes it an n minus R-form, apply the exterior derivative, which makes it an n minus R plus 1 form, apply the Hodge derivative on it, which turns it into an R minus 1 form. Apply the Hodge star. It turns out that from the point of view of the Hilbert space, the co-derivative is simply the same as the exterior derivative when you put it on the other side of the inner product. It is the adjoint operator. So whether you apply the exterior derivative on a differential form alpha and then take the inner product with beta, or you take the differential for alpha, take the inner product with the co-derivative of beta, you get the same thing up to a minus sign. This minus sign arises because of our definitions here, and you could plug in something over there to make this minus sign go away. But at some point, the minus sign has to pop up, but it doesn't have to be there. So I'm just warning you that in the literature, you will find that this definition is not quite consistent. Or the authors are not agreeing generally on how to define the co-derivative. Do you have questions over there in Guelph?
I think they're looking hard and looking us. I can see you there, probably in Guelph or at McMaster. Where are you?
That's McMaster.
Oh, McMaster. Where? I can't do anything from here. I think I can only hope that we figure it out. What then is the Dalembert doing in this Hilbert space? Remember that the Dalembert maps R-forms into R-forms, and does it by mapping R-forms into this anti-commutator of the exterior and the co-derivative. And by the way, we can already tell from this definition now that since
D and del are adjoints of one another, and that this expression has to be self-adjoint. So indeed, this is a self-adjoint operator. Doesn't matter whether you put it left or right. You can check that, and I put it over here in small script. And you can also verify, and I invite you to do this, not a long calculation, that the D'Alembert operator commutes with the Hodge star, commutes with the exterior derivative, and commutes with the co-derivative. So we just saw that the D'Alembert operator is self-adjoint. That has various interesting implications. First of all, it means that the Laplace or D'Alembert operator, as the case may be, depending on the signature of the metric, can be diagonalized and has a real spectrum. For Riemannian manifolds, it means that the spectrum of the Laplace operator is positive. For pseudo-Riemannian manifolds, that's not so. For Riemannian manifolds, if they have a finite volume, it turns out that the spectrum of the Laplacian is discrete. And then, in the case of Riemannian manifolds with a finite volume, it turns out that the spectrum of the Laplacian is nearly in one-to-one correspondence to the manifold with its metric. Which is to say that if you know the manifold and its metric, then of course you can calculate by the methods that we just had what the Laplacian is and diagonalize it and get the spectrum. And the amazing thing is that generically, if you're given the spectrum, in principle, you can work out what the manifold and its metric were. This discipline that investigate the connection between the spectrum of the Laplacian and the manifold and its metric is called spectral geometry. And notice something very interesting about this on mathematical grounds. Spectral geometry, this discipline that connects this with that, has one foot in differential geometry because it is concerned with this. On the other hand, it has another foot in functional analysis because it is all about the spectrum of a certain operator in Hilbert space. And this I find, personally, I find it intriguing because those two disciplines, differential geometry and functional analysis, are at the heart of general relativity on one hand and quantum theory on the other. Differential geometry being the language of of relativity and functional analysis being the language of quantum theory.
Well, might have to do with it.
And what's the intuition for that? Why, what does it mean that from the spectrum of the Laplacian, we can work out what the shape of the manifold is? Why would we be able to do so? Let us look at a Riemannian manifold and think of it as a thin piece of metal, rigid, and then we take a pencil or something and bang on it, it will make sound. This would be the type of equation that describes the sound that we get. It's a wave equation. And if we calculate the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian, which we can do once we're given the manifold, we can work out what the Laplacian is exactly. And in principle, it's just a matter of solving some complicated partial differential equation. In principle, we can work out, given the manifold and its metric, what the Laplacian is and what its spectrum and eigenfunctions are. Let us assume that the BR of X are the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on some finite volume Riemann manifold, and lambda R are the eigenvalues. Well, then we can solve this equation with this answer. We then have that the general solution of this wave equation that describes the sound that this manifold would make is this linear combination, a linear combination of those eigenfunctions with these frequencies here. You see, those frequencies is what you would hear. So the point of spectral geometry is that if two manifolds viewed as rigid, made out of rigid metal, look different, then they sound different, generally. There are known examples where two manifolds look different and they sound the same, but these are very fine-tuned special cases. And generically, we have that as you change the shape of a manifold, its overtone spectrum changes continuously. And in principle, from listening to the spectrum, you can tell how it looks like. In a way, you are Fourier transforming differential geometry. If you're interested, this is going to be one of the possible topics for an essay. Over the weekend, I plan to update our course website and put some more topics there. Okay, so now we turn to a different topic. We have, but related to what we just said, what we just said was we can describe the shape of a manifold in two ways. We can either describe it by giving the metric on the manifold, or alternatively, we can say what it sounds like. So these are two different ways of describing what manifold we deal with. The second possibility, at least, is a possibility when the manifold has finite volume and is Riemannian. Now here, is another possibility of describing the shape of a manifold. And we already started discussing that last time. Remember that when a metric has been specified, one can calculate the distances and locally and globally. And so therefore, the standard way that we discussed so far of specifying that what the shape of a manifold is essentially to specify how the law of Pythagoras is violated. See, the way that we have so far described the non-triviality of the shape of a spacetime is by saying Pythagoras is violated. You see, if the metric is non-trivial, it means exactly that a squared plus c squared minus c squared is not equal to zero for a triangle with a right angle intersect. If you draw on a complicatedly shaped manifold, a triangle with a right angle in it, then the angles won't add up to 180 degrees. And generally, a squared plus c squared plus c squared, where these are geodesic distances, don't add up in the way that a squared plus c squared minus c squared is zero. So that's the metric way of describing that the manifold is curved. But there is another way of describing if the manifold is curved, namely by describing how parallel transport is affected. Remember that example that we went through? If you're standing on the North Pole of Earth and you're pointing in front of you, then you walk towards the equator, always parallel transporting your arm. So you're not turning left or right, you're just parallel transporting your arm. And when you arrive at the equator or whatever latitude you want, then turn left, parallel to the equator, always have your arm pointing in front of you as you go along. And then eventually you walk backwards towards the North Pole again. And as you arrive there, your arm is no longer pointing in the same direction. This could never happen if you had walked on a flat plane. So this is an indication, the non-triviality of parallel transport. It's an indication of the presence of curvature. And it turns out that you can describe the shape of a manifold entirely by describing how the parallel transport of a vector is affected. So for that purpose, we define the so-called covariant differentiation. The covariant differentiation will tell us how much a vector is affected by, how much the direction of a vector is affected by parallel transport. Here's the basic definition. A linear map of tangent vectors, or tangent vector fields, which maps two tangent vectors into a tangent vector, let's say the tangent vector eta and the tangent vector xi into this expression here. This is how we will call it. That obeys the following two axioms will be called the covariant derivative, or also affine connection. Here, the basic idea will be this. We will define something like a Newton-Leibniz limit, eventually, where we say we look at the vector field here, and we look at the vector field over there. We take the difference between the two and divide that by the distance, let the distance go to zero, just like the usual Leibniz-Newton limit. We did already something like that for the Lie derivative. Now we do it for the covariant derivative. For the Lie derivative, we had to invent a way of identifying vectors at one point, or tensors at one point, with vectors at another point. And we were able to do this because we had this flow on the manifold. And then we could pull back our forms along this flow. Here, we parallel transport our vectors. So this is the intuition, and later, very soon, we will do that explicitly. But the cleaner way to do it is, of course, axiomatically, to define, namely to define our covariant derivative as a derivation again. So here's how we define the covariant derivative as derivation. The covariant derivative in the direction of a vector field psi of the vector field eta, so we're differentiating eta in the direction of psi, is supposed to obey the following axiom. If we covariantly differentiate eta in the direction of f times psi, where f is some scalar function, then this should simply be linear in f. We can simply pull the f in front. And the reason why we want that is that all the f does is lengthen or shorten the direction vector in which we want to differentiate. We are not differentiating the direction vector. The direction vector simply tells us in which direction we are differentiating. And so we want linearity in that, as would be the case for ordinary differentiation. D by dxi, so, you know, this is linear in the xi. And secondly, the covariant derivative in the direction of psi of a vector field f times eta, where eta is a vector field and f is just a function, well, that covariant derivative should obey a Leibniz rule, because after all, this is the product of two things that we differentiate. So it should be the directional derivative of f times eta plus f times the directional derivative of eta in the direction psi. Explicitly, we want that the covariant derivative in the direction of psi of f eta is psi of f, because psi is already a directional derivative, and this is just a function. You know what the directional derivative of a function is, just psi applied to f times eta plus f times the covariant derivative of eta. Well, it's not yet clear. This is just the algebraic definition of it, and I will link it with the geometric definition that will show why this is parallel transport in a moment. But you see, the thing is that this is nice because this tells you the rule of the game, the rules of the game. So you know always, if you define it this way, you know always what rules you can use. You don't have to go back to the complicated definition in terms of taking a limit. Yes. Yes. It's a different derivative, though, and we'll get to the difference in a moment. Remember that this is going to be an alternative way of describing the shape of the manifold. We can do this even if we have never heard of a metric. Not only are we not given a metric, we don't even know that the concept exists, okay? We can start from scratch. You're given a differentiable manifold without a metric on it. You can say that whenever you have such a map that takes two tangent vectors and maps them into a tangent vector that obeys these two axioms, then you have the covariant derivative or affine connection. And the claim is that this tells you, if you're given one of those, this is actually specifying the shape of the manifold. Later, we will link this to the metric description of the manifold. How does the covariant derivative look like in a chart? Let us choose the bases that are most often chosen. Namely, assume we are given a coordinate system, we're given a chart, then those we know form a basis of the tangent vector spaces. So why not use those? Later, of course, we will free ourselves from this particular choice, but for now, let's go with such choice. Given a covariant derivative, let us look at how the covariant derivative maps one of those tangent vectors, or differentiates one of those tangent vectors in the direction of another one of those tangent vectors. So let's look at the covariant derivative of one of those tangent vectors, d by dx, j, in the direction of d by dx, I. The outcome of that is a tangent vector, right? Remember that what a covariant derivative is doing is it takes two tangent vectors and maps them into the tangent vector. The derivative of a tangent vector in the direction of psi is itself a tangent vector. Just like for the leader. But this means that the outcome of that has got to be a linear combination of the basis vectors again. So differentiating d by dxj, this vector field, in the direction of that vector field, d by dxi, is going to be up to some coefficient functions that depend on I and j, some linear combination of the basis vectors d by dxk. And these are the coefficients that we have. So if by some other means somebody gives you an affine connection, then you can calculate that. Or alternatively, you can invent your own affine connection simply by writing down some coefficient matrix function like that. Those coefficients are called the Christoffel symbols or connection coefficients. Once we know what the covariant derivative of these vector fields in those directions are, we can actually calculate the covariant derivative of all vector fields in all vector field directions simply by using our axiom. See, because this axiom, so these are the axioms for the covariant derivative, this axiom tells us how to deal with functions down here. That axiom tells us how to deal with functions over there. And therefore, these axioms allow us to extend this information so that we can evaluate the covariant derivative of an arbitrary vector field eta, which is, after all, just some linear combination of those guys, in the direction of some arbitrary vector field psi, which is, after all, just some linear combination of those guys. Let's do it. So we assume now that those coefficients are given. You can just pull them out of the hat. I mean, you make them up yourself if you want to describe a new manifold. Just cook up some coefficient matrix function. Then once you've done that, the covariant derivative of an arbitrary vector field theta in the direction of an arbitrary vector field psi is this. I'm just spelling out what eta is. Linear combination, psi is this linear combination. Then we can use the first axiom, which tells us that we have linearity in this argument here. So we can pull out those psi I because they're just scalar functions. And here we have a function times a vector. But we know how to deal with that using the second axiom of a covariant derivative. Namely, what we obtain is psi I in front, that's this one. And then we get two terms. We get one term where the covariant derivative is acting on that, leaving this invariant, that is this here. Okay, covariant derivative on a function is simply the derivative of that function, right? So this applied to a function is just the derivative. Remember this little piece up there? This, right? Covariant derivative of a function times the vector field is the covariant derivative applied to the function, leaving the vector field invariant. Covariant derivative applied to a function is simply the direction vector applied to the function. This piece was similar for the linear derivative. Mm-hmm. So we have this happening here. That's what we get when we differentiate in the I direction, the eta j. This is what the comma means, derivative with respect to d by dxi, leaving that vector invariant. And then we have to leave this function invariant, here it is written, and covariantly differentiate this vector field with respect to that vector field. And that is by this here, it's just that. Now we can collect our derivatives together. And we find that the full expression is this. So that's the covariant derivative of the vector field theta in the direction of the vector field psi. Something important that most of you will already be aware of is that the Christoffel symbols do not transform like a tensor. They don't form a tensor. Let's quickly verify that. Let us look at a different coordinate system, a different chart, x bar. Then we have a different set of basis vectors, namely the d by dx bar. And also we are differentiating in a different direction, d by dx bar a. So this expression, I hope you can, if you cannot read it, I will just read it for you. It's the direction vector is d by dx bar a, and we're differentiating d by dx bar b. In this new coordinate system, the outcome of that is just like in the case of the first coordinate system x, except that everything has bars. Okay, new Christoffel symbols, and whatever the outcome is, it has to be a linear combination of the bar derivative. One thing we can say right away is that this expression is equal to that expression because we know how these vectors look like in the old basis of the x. We know that this is the transformation law for them. Okay, so we have one way of expressing this derivative, namely as that. On the other hand, we can say, well, this derivative here, this one, we can also express in terms of the unbarred quantity. D by dx bar is, after all, simply the Jacobi matrix times D by dx without a bar. And similarly, here, this vector we can express in terms of a linear combination of the unbarred vectors here, simply with the Jacobian matrix. And here we have the Jacobian matrix consists of functions, just regular functions. So here we have a function times a vector, and here we have a function times a vector. We apply the Leibniz rule twice, just like we did up just a moment ago. And when we apply it twice, we obtain that this expression is also that. Let's just skip the tedious details of that, perhaps. The point is that we can express the Christoffel symbol expression, this derivative in the bar coordinate system like this, and also like that. If we compare the coefficients, we can deduce that the Christoffel symbol matrix valued function in the bar coordinate system is this when expressed in terms of the Christoffel symbol in the unbarred coordinate system. If that term was absent, then this would be a tensor, because these are just the right Jacobi matrices to transform contravariant and covariant indices. But it turns out that they are not covariant and contravariant indices of a tensor. And that's because of this piece here. See, this piece looks perhaps harmless, but it is independent of gamma. And because it is independent of gamma, this cannot possibly be a tensor. Because imagine in one coordinate system, gamma is zero. Just imagine you define a Christoffel symbol, you define the affine connection to be simply zero. Then that would be zero. But this generally won't be zero. So now we would have that the same tensor that is zero in one coordinate system is not zero in another coordinate system. But that cannot happen. Obviously, a tensor that is zero in one coordinate system is zero in all coordinate systems, because abstractly it's some linear map that does something. And if it maps everything into zero, it maps everything into zero, whatever basis you may choose. Yes?
Does this also allow us for the Christoffel symbols to be zero? For us to choose a coordinate system in which the Christoffel symbols are all zero?
Yes, actually you can do that always. That's right. You can always choose a coordinate system such that the Christoffel symbol is zero, at least at point of your choice. You cannot always choose a coordinate system such that the Christoffel symbol vanishes in a whole region. You can always choose a coordinate system such that it vanishes at a point. We will come back to that. In other words, there's always a condensation in which the covariant derivative is the origin derivative.
Because, as we will see later, you know, the covariant derivative has an extra term. It depends on gamma. And if gamma vanishes, the ordinary derivative. This transformation law is usually taken in the physics literature as a definition of the Christoffel symbol. And what it says is this: whenever you define a quantity that transforms in this way under change of charge, you can use it as a Christoffel symbol, and it will define an affine connection and the covariant derivative for you. Of course, in practice, what it means is this: you can choose your favorite coordinate system and just write down Christoffel symbols any way you like. And then, if you want to know what the Christoffel symbols look like in another coordinate system, just define them in this way. Right. Now, there is a notation here, namely, based on this definition of on this definition here, namely that the covariant derivative of those basic vector fields is given in this way, we introduce the following just a second. Here's the logic. We define the basic covariant derivative using the covariant derivative of the basis in this way. And then we found that the covariant derivative of arbitrary vector fields has this expression here. Okay? And you see that this is proportional to the psi I. You have simple linearity in here. Okay? So we could just, in a way, we could just drop the psi I here. We know that we can later on contract with an arbitrary psi I again. So what we can do is we can define now the covariant derivative of a vector field theta in the direction I. So for psi, the direction vector, I chose d by dxi. So the covariant derivative of the vector field theta, arbitrary vector field theta, in the direction of the basis vector d by dxi, the notation uses a semicolon, is theta k ordinary derivative with respect to xi plus that extra term here. This is exactly what we get when we choose when we calculated this expression here and we chose for xi d by dxi. Then we get exactly this expression here. This xi I is just the Kronecker delta, which is 1 only for the value d by dxi, in the direction of d by dxi. So with this notation, with this definition, we can then write the covariant derivative of an arbitrary vector field eta in the direction of an arbitrary vector field psi as the covariant derivative of the coefficients here times these basis vectors, and then contracting with the psi that defines what the direction is. So I may not have explained that very well, but just plug it in there and you will see it all fits together nicely. Okay. Now let us define the absolute covariant derivative, which is nothing fancy. It is simply the idea that we don't specify the direction vector. Let us specify the direction vector later. We just leave that open. And when we leave it open, the direction in which we differentiate, then we call the result the absolute covariant derivative. So what is this doing? Well, you're feeding it a vector field that you want to differentiate. And then out of the absolute covariant derivative, you get a 1-1 tensor. Because this still has a covariant opening here, covariant slot. you can feed it the direction vector. And once you fed it the direction vector, then you get your one tensor. Okay? So this is what the absolute covariant derivative is doing. Namely, it's doing it like this. The absolute covariant derivative, and notice that there is no psi here, because we're not specifying a direction, it maps a vector field eta into what we call nabla eta. Namely, you get the coefficients of the covariant derivative, tensor the basis vectors, the usual thing, but you also have the dxi. So if you feed now a direction vector, the direction vector will be eaten up by the dxi, and that will be contracted with the inlet I down here, which gives you the direction, which is different. So the covariant derivative of this contravariant vector field is this 1-1 tensor, where this is a function, this is a cotangent vector field, and that is a tangent vector field. So if we now contract the covariant derivative, the absolute covariant derivative of eta with a direction vector field psi, then we get what we wanted to get. The covariant derivative of the vector field eta fed the direction vector psi is this expression there, the absolute covariant derivative, fed psi. Psi goes into a covector. And what does that give us? Well, you have the dxi of psi, which is the psi of xi, which is the psi I. And so you just get this expression here. And that is, if you remember just the slide before, this is the covariant derivative of the vector field beta in the direction psi. So far, we defined the covariant derivative algebraically, namely as a derivative, as a derivation, as something that obeys the Latin rule. Now, what about the geometric meaning of the covariant derivative? After all, I promised it has something to do with parallel transport, and that it really expresses that and how parallel transport is not trivial, and that it, in this way, describes the non-trivial shape, the curvature of the space-time. In order to get at the geometric meaning of the covariant derivative, we start with this definition. Consider a path gamma that takes a parameter that you can think of as time, or just some parameter, and gives you a point of the manifold. So as you run through your parameter, you are describing a path in the manifold. Then consider a vector field eta on your manifold. And as you travel along your path, you look at the vector field eta. And more than that, you differentiate in the direction. You differentiate the vector field eta in the direction that you're traveling along the path. So you're traveling on a path in this manifold, and you're passing through a vector field eta. And wherever you are, the vector field eta takes a value, some vector. Now, gamma dot, if gamma is the path, gamma dot is a tangent vector. So now let us differentiate the vector field in the manifold in the direction that we are traveling, where we are traveling. If the vector field has a vanishing directional derivative, directional covariant derivative, in the direction in which we travel, then we say that it is autoparallel along this path. And the intuition will be that if you parallel transport this vector field, this vector, along the path gamma, then the vector field doesn't change. So you take, let's say you are at one point on your path. You look at what is the vector field's vector here. And then you simply parallel transport that vector as you travel along. Just as I said, you know, stretch your hand out in the direction of this vector. And then parallel transport it along your path. And then you find that the vector that you keep carrying along with you. Happens to be the vector field itself as you go along. So if you parallel transport the vector eta, this is also the vector that is present where you are at each point of your path.
The derivative is like being a parallel transport?
Yes, yes. The covariant derivative is the derivative on the basis of parallel transport. Mm. That's what we are after, right? So far, this is just a definition. We're saying that let's consider a vector field eta and differentiate it in the tangent direction to a path. Assume that this is vanishing, then you call it over parallel. If it's not vanishing, you don't have a name for it.
So, we see
so far, this is just a simple definition, and we get to it too early to match it to the parallel transport. So how does it look like in the chart? Here we have the tangent vector field, and here we have the path. It maps t into positions as a function of t. The tangent vector is what we get when we differentiate dx by dt. So it's dx by dt, and then multiply with those basis vectors. We've had that several lectures ago. So now we can work out exactly what that is when we differentiate an arbitrary vector field in the direction of the tangent vector, and then set that equal to zero. So what condition is this? Let's calculate, what condition are we posing on the vector field when we are asking for this equation to hold true? What exactly are we asking of the vector field? Well, we're saying that this is equal to zero. In this case, when it's spelled out, that's the tangent vector, dx by dt. And this is the vector field that we want to differentiate. We know that we have linearity in this vector, so we can pull this in front of the covariant derivative. Here we have to use the Leibniz rule. This is a function, this is a vector. So this thing is in front of everything. We have the covariant derivative of this function, well, that's just the eta by dxk. And we leave this vector the same, plus, by the Leibniz rule, leaving that the same and differentiating this. But remember that we know what that is. The covariant derivative in this direction of that direction is just given by the Christoffel symbol times the basis vector. And the eta is left invariant when we do the product rule. So overall, we obtain that this expression, which is that, see, dxk by dxk cancels out. And we simply have d eta by dt, that's this expression here, times d by dxi, it's over here, plus that expression times this one, which is exactly what we have over here, is zero. This is the equation that a vector field has to obey in order to be autoparallel to a particular path. Now, for this to vanish, this bracket has to vanish for each I, because these are basis vectors, and the coefficient in front of each basis vector has to vanish. So we end up with these n equations here for each I running from 1 to n, or from 0 to n, if it's space time. So we have that the vector field eta is always parallel to gamma if that equation is true. It turns out that this is a first order differential equation for eta. So we only have first derivatives in time here, or in t here. And therefore, if we give one initial condition, then the solution is unique. In other words, let's say we are not given an autoparallel vector field, we want to make one. Then we can do it the following way. We have our path, and we choose a starting point of our path, and we choose a vector there, a tangent vector there,
eta at that point. And then we ask, along this path, what are the tangent vectors that are orthoparallel? And they are the vector fields each other that obeys this differential equation. So we choose as the initial condition that at this point of the path, this is the initial tangent vector. And then we simply analytically or numerically solve this differential equation, first order, we've got the initial condition. And then we can calculate what the vector fields vector has to be along this path in order to be or the parallel to this path. And we know from the theory of ordinary differential equations that at least locally we have a unique solution. So there is a finite stretch along which we can do this and have a unique solution. Yeah, so that's what I just said. Given a path, the orthoparallel transport of a tangent vector eta at one point of the path to another point of the path is unique, at least for a finite stretch.
Can you have orthoparallel transport for any path?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's the point. For any path. Assuming that the manifold is smooth, you have differentiability and all that, and you can choose any smooth path you like, and for at least some finite stretch, you can orthoparallel transport any vector you like. So this means that the path gamma defines a parallel transport map, which we may call tau. So tau has nothing to do with this T parameter up there, okay? So tau is a map. It's the parallel transport map for a given path gamma. What it does is this. You take one point of the path and take a tangent vector,
solve the differential equation up there, and then through this solution obtain a vector at a later point in the path, in a tangent vector at a later point of the manifold. So it's mapping, so in this way you can create a vector field. And you can start out with one point of the manifold, for example, and then have paths that go in all directions. And at your initial point, you specify a vector. And then solving this differential equation up there, you can parallel transport that everywhere in the neighborhood. And that gives you a vector field that is orthoparallel to all of those paths that you want to. But we will need just one path. Now here's the proposition that links this parallel transport to the covariant derivative definition that we had before. Here's the picture. Here's the manifold. Here's our path. Here is one point of the path, gamma of s. Here's another point of the path, gamma of t. And we start out with a vector here, and then we parallel transport it along this path by solving this differential equation above. Which is to say that at any point of this path here, if you calculate what the covariant derivative is of this vector in this direction that you're transporting it, it's zero. So even though it may look as if it changes its direction a little bit, it doesn't according to our definition because we are parallel transporting it. The covariant derivative is not changing. It is always zero as we go along this path. So the proposition is the following. If we calculate the covariant derivative in the direction of gamma dot, tangentially to our path, of the vector field eta that is obtained in this way, that is generated in this way through the orthoparallel transport, this covariant derivative is exactly what you get in the Leibniz-Newton limit, where you take the vector field eta at the point S and then map it using orthoparallel transport to a later point and then differentiate with respect to it. So you are mapping it from here to a later point, but just infinitesimally, because all we're interested in is really the derivative with respect to it. In principle, this could be a definition. For our purposes, it is a proposition, because we already defined this thing algebraically, and therefore it is not trivial to show that that expression matches this. Of course, you could also not bother with the algebraic definition and take this as the definition of what you mean by a covariant derivative, and then that is just the name that you give to this right-hand side. But for our purposes, it's a proposition. I'm skipping the proof, though. It is in the text by Stroman. Now, the geometric definition has the advantage that it easily generalizes to arbitrary tensors, so that we can covariantly differentiate arbitrary tensor fields. This is because it's parallel transport of a tangent vector field induces the parallel transport of cotangent vector fields, and thereby also induces the parallel transport of tensor fields in the following way. Remember that the parallel transport mass tau with arguments S and T. S was one point, gamma of S was one point on your path. T was, or gamma of T is another point of the path. And tau of S and T is the map that parallel transports an arbitrary tangent vector at the point gamma of S to the parallel transported tangent vector at the point gamma of t. So it maps vector field or vector eta at this point to a vector at that point, parallel transported over there. And this means, as I said, that the parallel transport also of a covariant vector is, the cotangent vector is also induced. And the way we induce it is simply like that. If we parallel transport a vector, then we want the parallel transport of a covector to be such that parallel transport and mutual evaluation commute. So whether we first take a tangent vector and evaluate it with a cotangent vector, or evaluate the cotangent vector on the tangent vector, and then parallel transport, which is trivial because it's just a number. Numbers don't change direction. This is a scalar function, right? Once you evaluate the tangent vector on the cotangent vector, you just get a function. Its parallel transport is trivial. There's nothing to change orientation. Or whether you first parallel transport the vector and parallel transport the covector, and then evaluate them on another, which gives you a number, that should be the same. Okay? So this defines for us what the parallel transport of covectors should be. The parallel transport of a covector omega is that vector at this other point, which evaluates to our parallel transported tangent vectors to give the same inner product. And now that we know how the parallel transport works on tangent vectors and on cotangent vectors, we simply linearly extend the action of the parallel transport map to arbitrary tensor products of tangent and cotangent spaces by linearity. Concretely, let's say we want to take an arbitrary tensor S at an arbitrary point P and covariantly differentiate it with respect to a direction given by a tangent vector psi. Then the tangent vector psi can always be viewed as the tangent vector to a path. So So every psi at point P can be viewed as the gamma dot for pa. And the point P is then just the point that the path happens to pass through at C equals zero. You can always choose the path in such a way. And then we can extend the covariant derivative with a geometric definition, by the geometric definition to arbitrary tensors by defining it to be the Newton-Leibniz limit of what you obtain from this, from the parallel transport of this arbitrary tensor. See, we've just learned up here how to parallel transport arbitrary tensors. And we use this now to define geometrically what the covariant derivative is of an arbitrary tensor. It is the Newton-Leibniz derivative of the parallel transport of that arbitrary tensor. Similarly to what we did above, we can again define the absolute covariant derivative. Remember, that's no big deal. It's simply the omission of the specification of the direction in which we want to differentiate. Concretely, this means that the covariant derivative, the absolute covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor, feeds on several tangent vectors, several cotangent vectors, because after all, it is some tensor with some rank R and A. And each covariant component feeds on a tangent vector. Each contravariant component feeds on a cotangent vector. So it feeds on several tangent and cotangent vectors. And in addition to that, it feeds on another tangent vector, which is the direction in which we want to differentiate. And by definition, this absolute covariant derivative is simply the regular covariant derivative of S, which feeds on so many tangent and so many cotangent vectors in the direction of psi. It turns out that the covariant derivative is indeed a derivation in the space of all tensors, where the multiplication is a tensor product. So the covariant derivative in the direction of some tangent vector psi of the tensor product of two arbitrary tensors, defined as the Newton-Leibniz derivative of the parallel transport of the tensor product of the two tensors, is the same as if we first differentiated the first tensor and kept the second tensor the same, plus the other way around. This is the usual product rule, the usual Leibniz rule. And it's easy to check that this is true. It's just the parallel transport is a linear operation which we can pull out of the tensor product. And once we have that, you can use the fact that the Newton-Leibniz derivative obeys a Leibniz rule. And so you have that the derivative on these two is simply the derivative on the first tensor, the second, and vice versa. So you end up with it. The equation. Seen an equation C here. For that?
Oh, yes, right.
I wanted to make another comment here, namely, remember how we defined the action of the parallel transport on cotangent vectors. The action was to be such that parallel transport and mutual evaluation commute, whether you do one first and the other second, or the other way around, should not matter. Then in the next slide, we defined, using the parallel transport, the Newton-Leibniz derivative, the covariant derivative for arbitrary tensors. And this definition here now translates the fact that it doesn't matter whether you first evaluate neutrally, which is the same as the contraction of indices, an upper index with a lower index. The fact that the contraction commutes with parallel transport means that contraction will commute with covariant derivative. And that's something that is very handy in practical calculation. That's just the point I wanted to make. Down here, this equation up there implies that the covariant derivative and contractions do commute. Now, what is the action of the covariant derivative on tensors concretely in a chart? You remember that this, we know how it works out. This is simply linear in this argument down here. So we can pull those psi in front, psi L coefficients. And then we have the covariant derivative of a basis vector with respect to a basis vector. That just gives us the Christoffel symbol. But what then, for example, is the covariant derivative of a cotangent vector? Well, let us consider the tensor product of a vector field and a covector field. As we just discussed, we have a Leibniz rule. So the covariant derivative of this tensor product is by the Leibniz rule up there, the covariant derivative of the tangent vector field, which we know what it is, plus leaving eta the same and covariantly differentiating omega. Now we use that the covariant derivative and contraction commute, so we now mutually annihilate eta with omega. And then we obtain that the covariant derivative in the direction of psi of this, which is now just a function, is simply, well, the function, this, by the Leibniz rule, we obtain this. Let's see. Yeah, right. What we have is we are now calculating what's the covariant derivative of the neutral contraction of omega with mu. We obtain, as we contract this in here, we obtain that. As we do the contraction over here of this tensor factor with that tensor factor and this tensor factor with that tensor factor, we get those two terms here. The omega contracted or mutually evaluated with this tensor and this tensor evaluated with that. So we just get this expression over here. So therefore, we obtain an expression for the covariant. Let me show you a little bit more. Therefore, we obtain an expression for the covariant derivative of omega, the one form, the cotangent vector field in the direction of psi, evaluated, contracted with a contravariant vector eta. From this, right? We obtain that this is that minus this. So the covariant derivative of a cotangent vector field in this direction evaluated on a tangent vector field is given by this expression here, where this is the same as that, because this is just a function whose directional derivative we calculate, but the directional derivative of a function is, see, this direction vector applied to the function. That's the psi of this function here. And this thing we can evaluate as well, because this is just a vector field, and here we have a cotangent vector field. We can evaluate them on another. Now let's choose a special case. Let us choose omega to be a basis vector of the cotangent space, and eta to be a basis vector of the cotangent space. After all, if we know how these things work out for the basis vectors, we can work out by the Leibniz rule how they work on all tensors. So what we find then is that the directional derivative of the one form, the directional derivative of this one form now, evaluated against this tangent vector field, in this case, the particular basis vector here, is given by psi of, and here we have a basis vector in the cotangent space evaluated against the basis vector in the tangent space. That's just the contraction, which, just for fun, I wrote with this bracket here. This is the, it is just another way of saying that you evaluate this on that. So it's just expressing that it doesn't matter whether you say that this eats up that one or this one eats up that one, same thing, right? And so this is a commonly used notation for a tangent vector evaluating on a cotangent vector and vice versa. In any case, that's just the delta ij, which is a constant. Therefore, the directional derivative of this constant function is zero. And here we have dxj, one form evaluating a tensor field. So it's the mutual evaluation of a cotangent vector on a vector. And that is the mutual evaluation of a dxj with, remember that the psi is really psi L d by dxl, and the psi is just a function that we can put in front by linearity. And then we are left with the cobound derivative in the direction of d by dxl of d by dxi. That's just a Christoffel symbol. There we go. Now we can pull this these things in front of this inner product evaluation, because they're just linear, they're just functions. We can just pull them in front of this evaluation. And then we evaluate this basis vector against that basis vector. That gives us a canonical jk, which means that this k turns into a j. And overall, we end up with this. And this, I use this bracket notation here, which is simply saying you have a cotangent vector here, you have a tangent vector there, you evaluate them to get a number. Sometimes it's a useful thing to do so that you keep apart what the structures are. Easier to see what you contract against what. Okay, so at the end of the day, what we find is that the covariant derivative, therefore, of the cotangent vector field basis vector dxj in the direction of a vector field psi is given by this, which is relatively easy to remember. Remember that the psi coefficients here, again, pull in front linearly. That's what we had before as well. And the rest of it simply adjusts so that the indices match up. See, this is an upper index, better contract to the lower one. And then this upper index has to contract with the lower one, and then we're just left with the j before an upper one. And remember that for the covariant vectors, covariant derivative, there's a minus sign here. Right. So this can be continued then for arbitrary tensors. It just works out exactly the same way as we just did. And for all the covariant components, we get minus signs. For all the contravariant components, we get plus signs, not surprisingly. So that at the end of the day, we obtain that the covariant derivative of an arbitrary tensor with so many contravariant components and so many covariant components, and these are the explicit coefficient functions, has the following covariant directional derivative. It is given by this expression here, where we introduce the semicolon definition. Now we generalized that now. We had the semicolon definition for the tangent vectors. Now we also have the semicolon definition for cotangent and arbitrary tensors. So we say that the covariant derivative of this tensor is another tensor with those coefficients of the same number of contravariant, same number of covariant components. And those coefficients here are given by this expression here, where the first term is the ordinary derivative of the coefficient functions of f. And then we have, with the plus sign, the Christoffel symbols contracting with the contravariant indices, and with a minus sign for each covariant index. This is something that's a little bit tedious, but please do check this out on your own. What we can then do, let me just quickly mention two things. In a special case, we had that the covariant derivative of a tangent vector field, then, it's just a special case of what we had above, is the ordinary derivative of the coefficient function plus the xij with the Christoffel symbol. For example, you may choose here the Kronecker deltas. If you just choose the basis vector again, then the xi would be constant. This term would drop out. This would just be a Kronecker delta, and you get the usual thing, where you have a covariant derivative of a basis vector, just gives you up to Christoffel symbol basis vectors again. For cotangent vector field, same story. The coefficient vector covariantly differentiated is the ordinary derivative, now with a minus sign, and then the Christoffel symbols again. And what we will do next, and we won't start it today, let me just mention, next thing is this. We have three ways now of defining the shape of a manifold. First way was through the metric. If we can tabulate, if we can list all the distances, if we can calculate all the distances between points of the manifold, then we can describe how Pythagoras is violated. And that, in essence, tells us exactly what the shape of the manifold is, because for one type of violation of Pythagoras, there's only one type of manifold that will do it. And then we said that the sound of a manifold, the spectrum of the Laplacian, at least for Riemannian finite volume manifold, that the sound is also a nearly one-to-one correspondence to the shape of the manifold. Here now we said, wait a moment, there's a third way of describing the shape of a manifold. Its non-trivial shape exhibits itself also in a non-triviality of parallel transport, in the fact that the derivative, as you parallel transport, is not just the ordinary derivative, but picks up extra terms. And we haven't really fulfilled that promise yet. We've defined the covariant derivative, all right, and parallel transport. But how exactly does non-triviality of parallel transport relate to the notion of curvature, and therefore to the shape of the manifold? That's what we will do next. Calculate from a given set of Christoffel symbols, from a given definition of the affine connection, what the curvature of the manifold is. So the next concepts will be torsion and curvature. Okay, so remember that there won't be a class on Monday, and then next Thursday the class will start later at 5:45, and then after that we will have regular Monday and doubled up system. I will put that on the web, and also will email you about this, make sure. And also over the weekend, I will post on the on our course webpage topics for the essay, and something about the final as well. Any questions?
Any questions in Guelph or wherever it might be then?